Okay, now I'm recording. Man, that would have been a disaster.
Yeah, yeah. Make sure you are, because I've got no recording facility here at all.
Man, I'm glad I looked at that. Yeah, it looks like we're recording now. Okay, good. Boy, the audience at home has missed such great content.
2 minutes of banter. Yeah.
I just ran home. I feel all discombobulated. I don't have my browser up. I don't have my tabs open. So you know, this is July 16th, 2013. This is episode number 52 of the Bigfoot Show. Episode, for those scoring at home, this is 052. We have desperately been trying to put this show together for the past couple of days and have finally been able to pull it off. But I just got home. My good friend Paul is in Africa, for God's sake. Sam was probably just changing a diaper, like,
yes,
just before the phone, just before this started.
Actually, I was. I like threw the baby at my wife and said, here, take this thing.
We're doing a show, damn it. Yeah. Take this mewling child away from me, woman.
Which, you know, that really speaks to how long it's been since we've done a show. I've had a child since the last time that we did a show.
Well, I was thinking, what are our excuses, right? Well, Scott's in Spain. I was in the woods for 18 days. Paul's in Africa. You had a child. Well, not yes. You didn't have the child.
No, I did not, but I was there to help contribute.
You're dealing with the child. And,
yes.
Well, you're not dealing with it in the same way you deal with an infection, but you know what I mean. You're loving and cherishing it and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, in some ways it is similar. I mean, it keeps me up at night, and it's wearing down my immune system. So there's some similarities there.
That's exactly right. This is number two for you guys. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I'm very excited about that. The pictures are adorable.
He's a good-looking kid. We make good-looking children. So,
yeah. Do you know the day that my son was born was the day that we had to listen to that bloody awful interview with Bob Hieronymus, the very first one that he did with Greg Long.
Wow, you remember?
Literally, I got back from the hospital, and within an hour, I was middle of the night for me. I was listening to Bob Hieronymus and Greg Long witter on about how brilliant they were.
Is that, and I remember when you came on to the BFF at the time, it's still the BFF,
yeah,
but at the BFF at the time, and you said, oh my God, these guys might have something, but.
No, I didn't.
This is
before then, back way, way back, a year before then. Because they did that interview, for me, they did that interview on what would have been the early hours of the morning on, my son was born on the 1st of March 2004. So the very early hours of the 2nd of March 2004 for me. So it would have been the evening of the 1st of March 2004. Greg Long went on the radio and with Cal Korf and sort of introduced Hieronymus for the first time. But a year before then, back in God, I think it was April 2003, I'd met Cal Korf at a convention in London, the 14 Times Unconvention, where he did this presentation on you know how the Patterson-Gimlin film was a fake and all sorts of things. And basically he was full of shit. I mean, he really didn't, he hadn't even read Greg Long's book properly, but was there promoting it. The takeaway from me from that was that one of the things that he said was that the reason that he didn't mention Bob Hieronymus by name back then, the reason Hieronymus was walking funny in the film, had this sort of weird gait of not locking his knees and all this sort of stuff that's sort of well discussed, but you know, over the years by now, was because Hieronymus had been in a car accident. But when you actually read the book, the car accident happened 3 years after the film. And he clearly hadn't read the book at that point. And at the time, the book was called something like 60 Seconds at Bluff Creek. And by the time it was actually published a year later, it was renamed. But that was the...
That's a way better title.
But yeah, 60 Seconds of Bluff Creek was a much better title than The Making of Bigfoot. But yeah, after that, after sort of meeting Korf, I sort of went on BFF and said, you know, this thing's going to, you know, shit's going to hit the fan soon when this book gets published. People need to start, you know, understanding the Patterson-Gimlin film better, learning the facts about it, what we do know, because, you know, people that want to defend it are going to have to do some work. And I was right. And I think, generally speaking, the book was pretty much discredited. I mean, there was an awful lot of crap in it, an awful lot of inaccuracies, but there are still just a few nuggets that are interesting.
We're not going to make this about the BFF. I'm sorry, the PGF. But you think that today the understanding of what went into the PGF is better or worse or the same as the understanding of it, say, in the 70s, like right after it happened, like in the early 70s? Do you think we have a better handle of the sort of the film, the events of the film, the timing of the film, or no?
Oh, I think it's much better. And I think, weirdly, I think that book did a lot of good. I think we know an awful lot more about the events surrounding the Patterson-Gimlin film than we did before the book was published.
Yeah.
I think it forced everybody to learn an awful lot more about the PGF. I think it was just one of those things everybody took it for granted. And I think the book did a lot of good. It forced us to evaluate it a little bit more harshly than perhaps we had done before. I mean, there's always going to be those that are going to hold the PGF up as the Holy Grail and the likes of Bob Gimlin as some sort of saint when clearly he wasn't. But, you know, I can't do anything about those people. I think in general, I think the book actually worked out quite well. I think we learned a lot more. I think we can look at the PGF in a much better light now than we could before.
Right.
I think. You know, the likes of Roger Knight, for example, I think he did fantastic work after the book was published, sort of just pulling it apart and saying, pointing out just how crap the book was in most parts.
Yeah. I'm looking, and the last show we did, the last panel show that we did, like this one, was back on April 21st. It's been almost 3 months.
Wow.
I'm telling you, if I was a subscriber to this show, if I had actually sent good money in to subscribe, I'd be asking for my money back right now.
Did people send good money?
No.
I'm just wondering because my bank account's kind of empty. And I was just wondering if all the money had gone into your bank account, I'd be having words with you, Brian.
No, I'm not holding back on you guys. I'm not.
Yeah, there's a reason Scott's not back from Spain yet. He's waiting for the money to turn up.
He's washing dishes trying to buy his way back. but you know, it's going to be like a record label though. There's going to be some marketing expenses that have to be taken care of prior to you guys getting paid, of course. Mm. You know, there are some sort of administrative costs that will need to be covered prior to. But I'm sure we'll get to you. I'm sure we'll at some point when all this money starts rolling in.
It kind of sucks. I think we discussed a year ago. I was planning on going out to do some hiking with Scott.
Yes.
Before he finished and this stupid job got in the way.
So he was on your continent and then you left. Is it because of Scott that you left the continent?
Not quite.
I mean, you have the channel there between you. It isn't like he was going to just show up at your door.
No, honestly, I was ready to book a ferry. I was going to go down with my son. We'd organized, we can get a ferry from England right down to the north coast of Spain. So it was going to be a great way. We're going to take the car, take the truck down, and then figure out where Scott was going to be and meet up with him, do a few days hiking. And then my son and I were going to drive back through Spain and France, back to England after sort of 3 or 4 days hiking. It was going to be really good.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah. And then work gets in the way.
Was he okay with that? Because I remember once I offered, I was like, hey, it would be awesome to like hike with you. And he sort of like, no, he's like, no, you're not gonna hike with me. He basically like, he's like, shut me down. It's like, I couldn't handle, you know, his professional hiking. Like there was no way.
Yeah, we kind of had a bit of a moment like that. I said, you know, you've got to bear in mind that I'm bringing a 9-year-old kid with me, and he's not going to be as fast. You know, kids are soft these days. I mean, 9-year-old kids don't go hiking the way they should do.
I said you'll be
okay going, you know, slowing down for a few days, won't you? Oh, I'm not sure about that, he says.
You know, down in Sam's neck of the woods, by 9, they've shot their first bear. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Skinned it out, made an area rug for their playroom.
little like, you know, Tinker Toys with the bones. So okay, let's I did a really crappy job, which is not unusual, of putting together the topics. But the first thing we want to get out of the way very quickly, we talked about this ahead of time. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we have to sort of touch on Melba Ketchum again, because there was a really terrific article that came out in the past week or so about the Ketchum thing.
Fiasco.
Okay, there you go. And it was by Ars Technica. And if you haven't read it yet, you probably should. It's a really nice sort of summation, I think, of what went wrong. Is that fair?
Yeah, it was a really nice article.
Yeah.
I personally think it was far too generous. But it was generous in a nice way. It was even, and it was the sort of article that if I were to write an article about it, it's the way I would have liked to have written it.
But I know that
I wouldn't have been that nice.
It would have been a lot more, nasty. No, he was. Well, I think that by the time you get to the end of the article, the author of it, whose name I don't have in front of me, I'm afraid, he has spent time talking to her. So I think that he probably felt that she was a nice enough person, just very badly. Sort of
crazy.
Sort of crazy. Sort of the only problem with her is she's nuts. But other than that, so I think that what we have to do now is we have to put a fork in it now. We have to just sort of like put Melba back on the shelf. And unless she says or does something crazy, we don't need to talk about her anymore.
Well, you see, isn't that a given though?
Well,
I mean,
once
she starts to see her star kind of setting on the horizon, isn't it a given that she's going to come back with something even crazier to keep her name and her presence out there?
She doesn't have to. Her sycophants will do it for her.
Yeah,
that's the nature of the beast. She has a following that, you know. I mean, this is what I. You know, we talked about this before she even self-published her paper, that it actually didn't matter what the content of her paper was. Mm. People would misunderstand it, misrepresent it, and represent it in a completely different way to what she was even trying to say in the first place.
Yeah.
She almost didn't need to publish anything in the first place. She was always going to have. She was always going to end up with forest people followers that believe these things, you know, make their own pancakes in the middle of the woods.
Well, they would if they had electricity.
And batter.
Don't have enough batter, damn it. I think you're right. But then you also look at the 50 years with Bigfoot or whatever it was, that crazy book that came out, in the early aughts.
Yeah,
That just sort of drifted away, and you don't hear people defending that anymore.
I don't think it had as anywhere near as many followers.
You don't think? That's possible.
No, I don't think it did.
Yeah, but I think she's done. Until she does something equally crazy. Now, of course, the deal is we have to talk about it. It is the Bigfoot show, after all. So we can't, like, if she just says something completely nuts, we have to talk about it, right?
Well, we should call this the Giant Sloth Hybrid Show.
Just this once, just this episode, right? Mm-hmm. Just this episode. So anyway, that's her. We're just gonna
the possum show.
Now I want to talk about what was a really cool story for about 18 hours. The Les Stroud thing, right?
Boy, that went down the toilet quick.
Fast.
amazingly fast.
Go on, fill me in. I know nothing about this.
Do you know who Les Stroud is?
No.
Okay, that's because you're from another country. So Les Stroud, he's Canadian, actually. So he's like you. He's not American. So I would assume that you would know him because he's not American.
So I probably like him.
You probably do. Right? He does Survivor Man, TV Survivor Man, right? And his shtick is they take him out in the middle of nowhere. Don't say he's like Bear Grylls because he's not.
So he's a Bear Grylls type.
No. Bear is a pale substitute for Les Stroud. Les Stroud
we have a chap in England called Ray Mears that does Bear Grylls properly.
Well, so anybody's better than Bear. I mean, Bear drinks his own pee, for God's sake. So you take Les out and they throw him in the middle of nowhere and they give him they pretend like he's crashed or something, right? Like sometimes he'll be out in the middle of the desert and he'll have a broken down motorcycle, or you know, he'll be out in the middle of like Australia and there's a crashed plane. So he has like just the stuff. It's survival, right? It's pure survival. And he films himself. He doesn't have a film crew with him, and he does this thing. And he's, you know, truly awesome. He's a really cool dude. And he's the guy that has had and has talked about a couple of times. I believe he was in Canada. I could be
Alaska.
Wrong. Alaska, right? Yes. Which is connected to Canada, from what I understand. If I remember my high school geography, it's connected. Anyway, he was in Alaska, and he heard some, you know, really weird vocalizations, sort of like monkey-like, you know, type stuff. And so he's had a bit of an interest, I would say, in the subject. But he wasn't, like, in the Bigfoot sphere. But then it came out that Les was going to do a show. He was going to do a show about Bigfoot, which was great because Les is cool. And do you remember who he's going to do it for, Sam?
Discovery TV?
See, I don't have my tabs lined up. That's
Science Channel.
Science Channel.
Yes.
Yeah.
See? And it's science. This will be great. So we were very excited.
Yeah.
And as I said on the Bigfoot Show Facebook page, which is facebook.com/TheBigfootShow, massively looking forward to seeing what Les Stroud was going to do with Bigfoot. That was on July 9th. On July 10th, 11th, really not even a day later, we found out that Les's guide to Bigfoot will be Todd Standing.
Oh, shit.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah,
seriously, if Sad Trombone was ever meant to do,
And I think what made this so just crushing, even though it had only been out there for just a little bit, Bigfooters in general had been trying to drag him into this subject for so long.
Yeah,
I mean, from the very first time he even hinted at the fact that something may have happened to him while he was out there, we've been desperately trying to drag this man down to our level.
Right.
And so for him,
down to our level, yes.
For him to come out and say, you know, yes, Survivor Man, Les Stroud, I'm going to do this, you know, two-night special. It couldn't have gotten any better. And then, it's like somebody just peeing right into your Wheaties.
Right into the Wheaties. Yep. So here I have a theory. My theory is that, and I don't want this to be true, but this is my theory. My theory is that Les wasn't going to give the Bigfoot thing. He doesn't take it seriously, right? That's my theory. Mm. My theory is that he was going to do the show, but that he wasn't really going to, at the end of the day, he was going to create a show. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. To create a show that would basically, you know, reinforce his position that Bigfoot's a load of crap and that he's not out there because he's been out in the woods for all this time and he's never seen one, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, of course, if that's your position, you're going to bring in the craziest, you know, batshit crazy person you can find. And, I mean, Todd Standing's the guy that Matt Moneymaker rolls his eyes at, right? That's who this is. So if you're the guy who Matt Moneymaker...
Hang on. Let's be fair. Matt Moneymaker probably rolls his eyes at a lot of people, including us.
But the point is, but for different reasons, right? Anyway, so if that's the case, if it's the case that Les was going to do sort of a jokey thing or like a... you know, here's why Bigfoot's a load of crap and look at these crazy people that look for it, then Standing's your guy, I think. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really disappointing. What's really interesting is that we posted it to our Facebook wall. 27 people shared the link that Les was doing the show, And then when we came back and said that Ton Standing was doing it with them, only three people shared that. So it's,
it speaks volumes right there.
The people have spoken. Yeah, I think the So
you know, it could be. He doesn't strike me as the kind of person who does anything with a guide. I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of his other works. He's got two or three documentaries out there. There's one where he and his wife and their kids, they go out into the Canadian bush and try to live for a year off the grid completely. And there's another one, I think it just features him and his wife pretty much doing the same thing. And so he's always been, you know, out there on his own. I mean, that's his shtick, is that he goes out there and does it himself. And for him to come back and say that he's going to have a guide, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, what exactly is that really going to be? Right. I mean, I can't imagine him being out there having someone leading him along and telling him, you know, this is what we're going to do. And then, you know, this is where we need to look and this is how we need to act. It just doesn't jive with all of the other body of work that he's done.
I suppose the glass half full side of it could be that he just doesn't know what Todd Standing is like. And in the fullness of time, he will realize this and see.
And I mean, they haven't even gone into production yet. So there's plenty of time for things to change.
We can only hope.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you say that, but of course we've, you know, it's not that long ago since we've had a documentary crew out with Rick Dyer. I mean, any documentary crew must have Googled to see what sort of person they're dealing with.
Yes, but that documentary crew was looking for crazy people. I mean, that was their whole thing was, we want to find the craziest Bigfooters possible.
Exactly. So it makes me wonder why the choice of Standing as somebody to be associated with. It wouldn't be difficult to spend 5 minutes with Google.
Unless you wanted a Canadian.
Discover who you're talking.
There's lots of guys in Canada to do this with.
Oh, there's plenty.
Right.
There's plenty of really good people they could have hooked up with.
I'm trying to remember the guy.
Really
name.
Good people.
Who's the guy?
Steinberg.
Yes. Yeah. He would have been my choice. If you're like, what comedian should he go with? Thomas Steinberg.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Top of the list.
Right.
I don't know. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't hold out any hope of it being anything serious.
Why does television suck so much? Speaking of television,
because it has to pay for adverts.
Speaking of television, there's another new show coming out. This is on the Spike Television Network, Spike TV. I'm trying to find the exact name of the show.
Oh, hang on, we talked about Spike TV ages ago.
Did we? Well, now
the
$10 million Bigfoot bounty is official.
That's what it was. Yes,
$10 million Bigfoot bounty. It's official.
Yeah,
it's happening.
And did we get some of that?
It's about to go into production, and it's going to be horrible. I'm fairly certain. But you know what? I've heard some rumors about who the judges are going to be, and I don't know. I think it's going to be horrible. I think it's going to be absolutely a train wreck.
It's Simon Cowell?
No, that would be no. Piers Morgan either.
That's a show I'd pay to watch.
The theory is the way the show works is you send out these teams that are going to competitively Bigfoot. It's going to be like competitive Sasquatching, and then whoever brings in the proof, you know, according that is proof that satisfies the panel of judges. Then that person wins $10 million or that team. There's a team of two people.
But you just know it's going to be a show trying to demonstrate who the most stupid person.
Well, of course, I know
that's what the judges are really judging.
That's
it's nothing to do with the evidence.
They want. I mean, without wishing to sound rude to Bobo, but they want people falling off porches.
Of course, right.
And I don't mean that in a nasty way, because that clearly was not something that was intended. But that's what Spike TV has seen and thought. God, we could get loads of people doing this.
Oh, and Spike's going to be the worst, right? Animal Planet is like Sesame Street compared to Spike TV. I mean, they're gonna want like rude and crude and women, you know, fighting and scratching each other, and it's gonna be horrible. I mean, that's what they want.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
They claim it's the largest largest cash prize in television history. And they think that you know, because it's backed by Lloyd's of London, that's some sort of, like, you know, stamp of approval. But Lloyd's is an insurance company, right? So they're basically like, oh, sure, we'll take that bet. You know, these guys are going to go find proof of Bigfoot, you know, for $10 million. Yeah, whatever. No problem.
Yeah. Being backed by Lloyd's of London is not a good thing. We had a financial meltdown here a few years back, as many countries did. Lloyd's of London was one of those weird companies that basically shafted all of their investors, including some very high profile celebrities that lost lots of money with Lloyd's.
It
doesn't have being backed by Lloyd's of London doesn't have the
cachet. Sort of impact.
Right. Yeah, not that it used to. People used to dine out on being a Lloyd's of London investor. Now they can't afford to dine out because they've got no money left.
Well, I think the show will be airing in the fall, so that's good for us. It'll give us lots of stuff to talk about. It's going to go on for several weeks, so, you know, theoretically, we could. This will give us a lot of grist. This is good.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I'm at the stage now where, hey, show me stupid Bigfoot people.
Sam, would you go out for a TV show? Would you ever sign up for something like this?
No. I have a face for radio. In all seriousness, I mean, I've flirted with it briefly. I did a local TV interview one time that was traumatic, and then I helped with the production of a student art film back in 2006 or so. And it was fun, but you just see, I've never seen anyone come out of one of these shows and say, wow, I'm really glad I did that. That went exactly like I thought it was going to go.
That's a really good point. I know nobody that's ever said that.
They always come back and say, that was such a load of shit. That was not what we intended to do. They didn't use the good stuff. They edited us. No.
I bet even the folks on Finding Bigfoot would say that.
Did I tell you about my BBC experience? When was this? This was a few years ago. They approached us. I think everybody listening to the show knows that I own a computer forensics company, and we investigate sort of computer and mobile phone or cell phone thingamajigs and do all sorts of digital CSI.
So if you ever meet Paul, do not let him touch your phone.
What makes you think we have to physically touch them to see what's
happening? Oh, no, don't say that kind of thing. Anyway, go ahead.
I'll tell you, we've got some great kit now. We can actually take the chip out of your phone, Brian, even if it's password protected, and extract or everything.
You have to touch it. Next time I'm with you, my phone is going in my underwear. It is not going to come out in front of you. You're not touching my phone.
But even if you've got a password protected BlackBerry, if we've got physically get hold of it, we can take the chip off, read, extract all the data, or even all the encrypted messages and everything on it. We can just pull it all out in seconds. It's great. Anyway, we got approached by the BBC. They do a show where they investigate legal issues. I forget what they called it now. Rogue Traders. It was Rogue Traders, and it was part of another show that they did. It was like a little segment within another show. But it's a fairly high-profile BBC show. And they called us in, and they said, we've got this thing we need to look at, and I'm not going to go into it in too much detail because I'll have to name names then. But we want you to examine some computers for us, and this is what we think has been going on. So they brought us a load of computers to examine, and being the BBC, we didn't get paid for it. But before we actually got around to examining it, they wanted to do these interviews, and we spent hours and hours interviewing. Doing these interviews, explaining what we were doing, what we were looking for, how we'd set things up. There was a point at which they had visited my office, and we'd moved into this new office. It had these floor-to-ceiling glass partitions, and they were looking at it, and they were just almost having little mini orgasms at this office.
Wow. That's a nice office.
They said, oh, you know, oh, this is great. They said, we can light this up. We can, you know, floor to ceiling glass partitions. Can you do some mathematical equations in marker pen on the glass partitions like they do in CSI? I said, no, I'm not writing on the fucking walls. That's not what we do. These are walls, you know. If we want to write, we've got paper.
But it looks so cool.
But it'll look really good. That's what they actually said. Oh, but it'll look really
and
good.
And we'll backlight it and we'll make it kind of blue.
Yeah. And, right. And so at one point I'm explaining to them, I'm showing them, we use a computer forensics application that's used around the world called Elmcase. And it's a brilliant piece of software, but it looks really boring. I mean, it's like Windows Explorer with extra bits, and you can see files and you can see hex and you can see hidden space and you can unencrypt files and things within it. It's a fantastic tool, but it's dull. And I'm showing them the actual data that we're seeing. This is after we've done all the interviews and they've come back and they're seeing some data. And they said, okay. And I wish this was video, because they did this. They said, when we interview you again, said, could you put something on the screen that's all interesting and matrixy? And when they said, I'm not joking. When they said matrixy, he sort of wiggled his fingers and made his fingers look like it was going down the screen. You know,
I just wanted to make sure in case you hadn't seen the movie.
Yeah. And I said, no. He said, what do you mean no? I said, well, no. He said, why? He said, well, two things. One, this is what we do. It's really quite dull. And two, if this were to go out on TV and it's all interesting and matrixy, my competitors are going to sit at home and piss themselves laughing at me. This is what we do. Take it or leave it. And in the end, they left it. They did the show without us.
See, you could have been on TV. That would have been.
I could have been on TV. The problem was, and this was the disgusting part. The problem was that when we actually examined the computers that they asked us to look at, we found evidence that contradicted the show that they wanted to put out.
Oh, see, they wouldn't have liked you anyway then.
So they didn't like us, and I actually said to them, I said, well, this is going to put a real kibosh on your show. You're not going to be able to present the story the way you want to present it, because it's not true. So you presumably, you have some stories that you keep on the shelf ready to put in at short notice when you get something like this happens and you can't present the story that you want to. And they said, well, no, we're going to have to do this story. I said, well, you can't, because it's not true. So they went ahead and did the story without us, knowing that what they were presenting was a pile of shit. And they just excluded us, but they actually presented 30 minutes of a pack of lies.
You seem really sort of hung up on the fact that what they show on TV should be true. I don't understand.
Have you never watched television?
Television is, right? It's that little box with all the moving pictures on it.
No. Well, this is the thing. I can understand. I'm going to sound all horribly colonial and you know, sort of mother country here.
I can't wait.
But I do feel that a TV station that doesn't have advertisers, we pay a license fee in Britain. We pay, I think it's about £140 a year to pay for the BBC.
Fee, yes.
Yeah, if you like, socialist TV, they have a responsibility to the people that pay the license fee. They don't have a responsibility to advertisers. They should be telling the bloody truth, regardless of how entertaining it is. And they didn't, and I was really disappointed with them. But that's what television's like.
You've proven that you will have no future in television, none whatsoever.
I have a face for radio as well.
I will say that getting back to the $10 million Bigfoot bounty hunter hoo-ha, whatever it is, I did know a few people who were going for that show, and none of them got on. So now I feel relieved.
So who's on it?
Well, I know some of the names, and I don't want to get anybody in trouble, so I'm not going to say anything. But you're going to love a few of these folks, and all I know is that I'm really relieved that none of my friends are on the show, because now I can truly hate it and not feel guilty about it. Right?
Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah. But it's going to be interesting and matrixy.
Yeah, well, it'll be fun to watch, and I'm sure there'll be girls fighting and, you know, rolling
I'm old enough now to appreciate, you know, 25 minutes of TV with female mud wrestling if there's Bigfoot involved.
Okay, so. Next topic. Next topic is the apparently the Minnesota Iceman. If you remember, I don't think we ever talked about it on the show, but the Minnesota Iceman apparently was on eBay a little while back.
We haven't done a show since.
Was it before? Okay, well, it's been 3 months, right? So maybe it has. But now, so it actually, it turns out, according to, friend of the show, what's his face?
Lyle Blackburn, I think.
Lyle Blackburn,
saying
yes.
It's turned up in Austin.
Yeah, and he's seen it, and it's in the Museum of the Weird or something in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where we expected it to end up, somewhere like that.
But it's the actual, it's the original deal, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, well, yeah. It just demonstrates that, you know, our friend Vern was right. And
he was. He was 100%.
Lots of people wrong.
Yeah.
I feel quite vindicated about it because we, you know, when we spoke to Vern,
it's always good when you can feel vindicated.
Oh, absolutely.
I will tell you. You talk. I'll tell you when we talk to Vern.
It's nice. I think even when Vern talked, I think there were a lot of people that sort of said, "Oh, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about."
Episode seven yeah, came out August 24th, 2008. It came out.
Yeah.
So you were saying how vindicated you felt.
Yeah. We sort of put a stake in the subject and said, you know, well, everything Vern's saying sort of holds together. Everything we know about the Minnesota Iceman points towards it being a hoax. There's nothing we could see that demonstrates it being anything but a hoax. Of course, it was after we did our show that Lauren Coleman came out and said, "Oh, do you know what? I think it's a hoax now," and everybody sort of fell into line.
Yeah.
Put it this way, I think if it hadn't been for that show we did with Vern, I think it would have taken a lot longer for people to change their opinion on the Iceman.
That's our legacy right there.
Yeah, it's the one half decent thing we've ever done in 50 odd shows.
Killing the Minnesota Iceman. That's our, yeah.
Sam, what do you know?
Well, first off, I was just going to say, for anybody out there that really wants to know the true story of the Minnesota Iceman, you need to listen to the Bigfoot Show, episode 7, and you also need to check out Monster Talk.
Yeah,
they did an episode called "The Iceman Goeth." That had Matt Crowley on. And Matt's got a really interesting and unique perspective on it, in that he did sideshow work for 3 years, I believe.
Yeah.
And so he's a student of the game, and he really understood how it worked and how the promoters and the barkers worked their trade and everything. And so he provides a really really unique perspective and a lot of information about it. The thing about the Minnesota Iceman is it really illustrates what the hell our problem is. Frank Hansen comes out back in 66, and he goes to Don Post Studios, where Vern Langdon was working. And he's a carnival promoter. That's what he does. And he says, I need this gaff made. I need you to make this for me. And this is what I want, and I have a drawing. And what I love in the Monster Talk episode, I was listening to it this morning, is Matt says, you know, basically that Vern wasn't sleazy and that Hansen was, and that he wasn't going to operate on that level. So they recommended him to another guy, Howard Ball. And so Hansen goes to Harry Ball and has him create. Yeah, I know.
That's a bad name. Anyway, sorry.
Sorry.
He has him,
you know, he has him make this gaff and he starts to tour with it. And this is back in the spring of 67. And by sheer luck, Patterson comes out in the fall of 67 with the Patterson-Gimlin film. And so suddenly, you know, here's Hansen perfectly positioned to take advantage of this. And that's exactly what he does. And the next bit of dumb luck he has is the following year, Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans come and examine this gaff at his home. I think it was December of the next year. And they declare it to be real. And on nothing else this legend is built that Frank Hansen actually had a Sasquatch or Homo pongoides. Homo pongoides in a block of ice. Had it not been for Sanderson, the man who promoted the belief that a 15-foot-tall penguin had gone for a stroll on the beach in Clearwater, Florida, and for Heuvelmans, no one would have ever believed this. Everyone would have known this is a sideshow promoter and this is a sideshow gaffe. And for all the time since then, that's all the argument has been based on. There was no evidence. Nothing was, there was no sampling done. There was no tissue. Nothing was ever established other than their testimony that they believed that this was a real thing. And if you really want to get the skinny on it, you need to read John Napier's The Yeti and Sasquatch in Myth and Legend. He presents probably the most unbiased take on the whole thing. And he was an anthropologist. He was very well qualified to make the statements that he does in the book. And he really, in the way that the Ars Technica article dealt with Ketchum, he deals with Sanderson. Mm-hmm. But do yourself a favor, go find that, check it out, and then listen to the Monster Talk and the Bigfoot Show episodes. And if you walk away from it and you still think that there's even the slightest chance that this thing was ever legitimate, you should not ever let anyone take advantage of you in any.
It's something I've been wanting to follow up on for since we did the show. I was trying to get hold of the Heuvelmans papers that are held in a museum in Lausanne in Switzerland. And just as I was about to go out there and sort of start photographing these papers, because they have volumes of Heuvelmans' work, handwritten notes. They've got an entire volume just on the Minnesota Iceman at this museum in Switzerland. They told me that they'd put it in storage while they refurbished the museum, and they didn't know where it was, and it was going to take at least 3 years for them to get it out of storage again.
Wow.
So now is actually about the time when it's out of storage. It's back in the museum. And even though we can kind of stick a fork in the Iceman, I really want to see this paperwork. I want to see how seriously he took this. So at some point in the next year or so, I'm gonna go out to Lausanne and make copies of the documents. I've also got access. Somebody I know in Ireland has got a whole series of letters that he wrote to and from Sanderson about the subject back in the late 60s. Mm. Whilst Heuvelmans and Sanderson were investigating this. And these letters have never seen the light of day, and I'd really like to see them.
Yeah, it seems like those guys that were working in the late 60s, it seems like all of them would have fit on like one bus. Like everybody in the field of Sasquatchery would have fit on a single like Greyhound bus.
They would have fit in one Facebook group.
Yeah. Well,
other people would have pointed and laughed.
Yeah. Another tip of the hat needs to go to Rick West, because back in 2011, he put out a book called Pickled Punks and Girly Shows, and he was the one who presented the first photos of the Minnesota Iceman gaff that really had ever been seen without the ice on it. He went to Minnesota. He found the original showpiece, which is what is now at the Museum of the Weird in Austin, and took all these photos, wrote it up in his book, and it's kind of presented as sort of the crown jewel of that work. And that was something that really started to reignite the debate. I think it was the next year when it really started to first come out. But
do you know, are they showing it with the ice on it in Austin?
I do not know. I know that in what I read, that the freezer is broken. The guy who was selling it on eBay had it appraised by an HVAC technician who'd said it needed a new compressor. Whether or not that's been done, I don't know. It's still underneath glass. I know that much.
It would be way cooler if it was under ice.
Yeah.
If I was ever going to go and see it, and I really want to go and see it one of these days.
You're not going to see it. You're never coming back here. First of all, I know the NSA won't let you
Yeah, I it's not the NSA that I worry about. It's
all right. Well.
You know, it's a little bit of a diversion, but obviously Snowden's been in the news for the last few weeks for publicizing 4 PowerPoint slides. I mean, seriously, that's all he did, and he told us nothing that we didn't already know. Anybody that keeps a tab on what intelligence is doing knew what he was doing. Knew what it was in those slides. But the beauty of the way NSA and GCHQ in the UK work is that they spy on each other. GCHQ spies on Americans because it's illegal for the NSA to do it. and the NSA spy on British citizens because it's technically illegal for GCHQ to do it, and they just swap all the data.
See, that sounds great.
It's convenient.
Would you believe that it's something of a coincidence, but every fiber optic cable that leaves Europe and crosses the Atlantic goes through Cheltenham?
No.
In the United Kingdom.
I don't even know what Cheltenham is.
Cheltenham is where GCHQ are based in the west of England.
I see.
Every single fiber optic cable that crosses the Atlantic goes through Cheltenham. It's brilliant. They are fantastic people. I mean, I say this. My father worked for GCHQ for many years. People take it very seriously. The if there's one thing the British do well, it's spying on people. did I ever tell you about the Colossus machines? Because my father, who since the last show, my father died, and
yes, he did.
He wouldn't have ever wanted me to talk about what he used to do. But when he worked at GCHQ, he worked on one of the Colossus computers. And the Colossus computers, one of the very first digital computers that were built. And they were built during the Second World War to decrypt the Enigma codes that the Germans were using. The Germans were using these fantastic little wooden typewritery things that had this wonderful method of ciphering messages. And they were impossible to crack. And Alan Turing and some other fantastic people at Bletchley Park, just down the road from where my office is, eventually built this Colossus machine. And they were able to decrypt every single German message that was sent. And there was about 1,000 of these Enigma machines at one point. They're in every train station in Germany. Every single German commander had one of these decoding machines. And so for the last sort of couple of years of the Second World War, British intelligence were literally looking over the shoulder of the Germans. And it's reckoned that Alan Turing and the Colossus machine essentially enabled the war to be ended 3 years earlier than it would have been otherwise. And by all accounts, it's generally accepted that their work at Bletchley Park saved somewhere in the region of 25 million lives.
Wow.
And it's fantastic. And if there's any geeks out there, if you ever get the chance to England, go to Bletchley Park and see the original Turing bomb machines and the Colossus machine. They are marvelous. They've got a working Colossus. It's the only one left in the world. But at the end of the Second World War, Churchill was so paranoid about the power of these Colossus machines that he ordered for them all to be destroyed. There were 9 of them at the end of the war, and he ordered for them all to be destroyed. And his exact words were that they should be broken up into parts no bigger than a fist. But 2 of them were secreted away and carried on working for many, many years at GCHQ headquarters in Cheltenham, where my father came into contact with them. And the beauty of what they were doing was that at the time, contrary to American Hollywood movies, the Americans had no idea that the British had cracked the Enigma codes. They had no idea that the Enigma codes had been broken, and they didn't know about it until the late 1970s. But between the end of the Second World War and the 1970s, at the end of the Second World War, the British said, you know what, Americans and Canadians and Australians and all of our other allies. These clever Germans, they've got these wonderful little Enigma machines. They're brilliant at encrypting messages. You should be using them. And so they distributed somewhere in the region of about 600 or 700 of them to American embassies all around the world. The Americans and Canadians and Australians and the Kiwis and everybody else had no idea that up until the late 1970s, the British were listening in on every single message that their allies were sending.
That's not what friends do.
Yeah. So when the likes of Snowden say NSA's spying on you, they really are. It's what intelligence people do. If there's one thing the British do well, it's spying on people. It's fantastic. But I don't know how much press this gets in America. I know when what was her name? There was a GCHQ employee at the beginning of the Iraq War had leaked some documents that came from the NSA, where the NSA had told GCHQ staff, particularly the translators, which this particular woman, Catherine Gunn, her name was. Google Catherine Gunn and you get a really interesting story. But Catherine Gunn's story wasn't published in the United States at all. We had a big court case here in the UK because the NSA had said, do you know what, we're bugging everybody in the United Nations, including Kofi Annan, because we want to know how they're going to vote with regard to sanctioning the Iraq war. Mm. And this came to light, and we had a whistleblower at GCHQ, and it made the press here. But all the time this was going on, not a single mention in American press about it.
That's boring.
It was fascinating at the time. But it's got nothing to do with Bigfoot. I'm sure somewhere in the NSA or GCHQ, there's some really interesting documents on Bigfoot. They're probably spying on every Bigfoot researcher in the United States.
They're probably tapping in on this right now.
I have a friend
not
who...
This show.
We don't rate.
We use Skype, so they can't listen in.
Oh, right.
Obviously, because Microsoft don't.
Right, yeah, never mind about that.
The fact we publish a podcast probably negates necessity to intercept Skype. A few years ago, on a Bigfooty subject, a few years ago, the Ministry of Defense here had to publish a list. They were ordered by court to publish a list of people that were on their watch list, people that they were monitoring. And a friend of mine was on it. He discovered by means of a Data Protection Act request that he was on this list. And the only thing he could think of that caused him to be on that list was that he had written a book about crop circles.
Really?
That was the only thing he could think of that would cause him to be on that list. I have no doubt that I'm monitored. Certainly back in the 80s, I saw physical evidence that my parents' phone line was being recorded.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. We went to an open evening back in mid-80s, around about 85, 86. We had an open evening at our local telephone exchange. And this was back in the days when you had a little meter for every telephone in the town so they could give you a phone bill.
Right.
They couldn't authorize calls in those days, but this is pre-computerization. They had a physical meter for every phone. Huh. And as we looked around, there were some meters that had little boxes on the floor plugged into the mains with crocodile clips on either side of the meter.
Sure.
Do you call them crocodile clips in the States?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Those little clampy things.
Yeah. And my father, being quite mischievous, asked our tour guide what these were. I said, oh, he said, they're test equipment. Nothing to worry about, test equipment. my father had helped design this particular bit of test equipment, so he knew exactly
so
what,
he knew
it
what it was.
And curiously, one of the brilliant things about this tour was you could get to go and see your meter and see it ticking over, and you could phone your house for free for the telephone exchange.
That doesn't seem very useful. Where are you? Yeah. I'm at the telephone exchange.
But it wasn't a surprise to him that there were crocodile clips and a little box on the floor connected to our telephone meter. But that's the life of somebody that, that does that sort of work. You expect to be listened into.
Well, they're clearly not listening in on us.
No.
There's no point.
But I hope to think that somewhere there's a little NSA agent listening into a Todd Standing's phone calls.
trying to locate Sylvanic so they can invade it.
Anyway, that was a nice little diversion. But if we've got anything Bigfooty to talk about.
Well, we've got lots of questions. Actually, we have tons of questions. I don't have anything else. I don't think... There was one other thing I wanted to hit on. Oh, the dude with the Bigfoot head fossil. Did you guys see that video?
No.
The guy that says he went into a local paper and said he had a fossil of a Bigfoot head and it was out in his trunk. And oh, come on! I put this on the show page.
You did.
Yeah. And it's just a rock. It's a really big rock. Sort of a football sized. Or rugby ball, actually. It's a little bigger. And you can see its face. And he doesn't know what a fossil is, I don't think.
That man believes he has fossilized Bigfoot head.
Yes, a whole head.
Yeah. I'm looking at the photo now. It looks like a rock.
It is a rock, yeah. And then the sad thing is, like, the reporter's talking to the guy, and he's like, well, here's the eyes, and here's the nose, and here's... Anyway, yeah, people, that's not how fossils work.
The best thing to come out of that, though, was a little while ago, Jeff Meldrum posted a photo on his Facebook page of a rock that looked like a Bigfoot footprint. It looked like a cast. Mm-hmm. And it was, from what I could tell, it was in response to the whole Bigfoot head stone fiasco. And he made the comment that, you know, this was just testament to the fact that nature can produce effects that are surprisingly similar to other things within nature. Basically, that one element of nature can very similarly reflect another while not being related. And the first thing that popped into my head was, oh, you mean like casting artifacts looking like dermal ridges? And it took everything I had not to make that comment because I would like to keep him as a friend on Facebook.
But you know, the earth's a big place. On the balance of probability, there are a few rocks out there that look a bit like a Bigfoot head would.
Yeah, and the problem is this one really doesn't even look like a Bigfoot head. That's the problem. I mean, it just doesn't. You have to, like, really work at it to see what he's seeing in it. And, you know, I want to see, like, you know, I want to see eye sockets and a big dopey nose or something. But, yeah.
There's a real science to seeing stuff that isn't there. It takes a lot of training. Some people have that skill. And some people like us, we're just schmucks that can't see it. We can't see Bigfoot's cloaking and that sort of thing. We're not in the know. We shouldn't even be presenting this show.
We're clearly not qualified.
We can't see shit that other people see.
No, I guess not. I'm sorry, everyone who's listening. I apologize. A guy named Dan Williams, who's a fan of the show on the Facebook, kind of gets into he says, I'd like you guys to tackle what is, in my eyes, the biggest misconception in Bigfootery. Footage of a Bigfoot will never do. We need a body, quote unquote. I, for one, completely disagree with this statement. Have you seen what HD quality cameras can capture these days? Just imagine if you were to the right place at the right time and the right camera and came across the wild gorilla. And then you zoomed in on the eyes and the facial expressions. And see, I hear this a lot. And there's two things. Right? There's two things. HD video, as we've talked about on the show, is not as good as film.
No.
It doesn't have the same resolution as, you know, old-fashioned film stock.
Yeah. And that's
why amazing PDF when you really think about it.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. HD quality is not that fantastic. And in a prosumer camera, let's assume you're using a prosumer camera, it's crisp, but it's not like film. And secondly, this idea of like, well, if you came across a Bigfoot and you could zoom in on its face, well, sure. But if you could do that, it would have been done, right? I mean, this is like, I don't know. if they're not just sitting around waiting for you to take their picture.
Yeah.
No,
all I know is that last weekend I got within about probably 10 meters of a wild African elephant and still took blurry photos.
Yeah, see, well, that's that happens, right?
I honestly have photos. I should post them actually on our page. I have photographs of a leopard, and I know the leopard was there, and I can't see it in the photo.
Now that's a pretty good camouflage, right?
Yeah,
it's really good. I mean, it was just you just couldn't see it. But with the naked eye, I know it was there. I could see it, but I look at the photo, I can't see
it.
Yeah. Sam,
I was going to say I blame Bigfoot. In regards to Dan's question, as far as I know, there's only been one, maybe two instances where an organism has been cataloged and given a Linnaean classification based on photographic evidence. It may just be one, and in those cases, these are known organisms. Mundane organisms, birds, you know, smaller primates, you know, things like that. You are talking about a living legend. I mean, if it's out there and it's real, it truly deserves the title of living legend. When the expectation is that great, you're going to have to do better than film, simply because if you have a hard time getting a bird described and classified using, you know, clear photos or clear film, it's never going to work for, you know, a 7-8 foot tall, upright, hairy creature that's not even supposed to exist.
Yeah, that most people think is a joke anyway.
Right.
You've got a lot to prove.
Yeah, the bar is so much higher.
In today's day and age. It is. Right.
Yeah, it's higher than proving a bird.
Now, I will say this. I have made the argument in the past, and I think this could be true today. If you came back with really strong photographic evidence, you know, if you had a camera trap photo of one right there in front of the camera, clearly focused, taking a dump.
That'd be good, actually.
If you came back with the kind of video that he's describing, I think what you could get is the serious attention of academics or of corporations who could come in and provide the additional funding to get the job done and get this thing classified.
And what would those academics do? Because
we want McDonald's sponsored Bigfoot.
Yes.
It would be Wendy's, first of all. what would those heartless academics do?
They would kill one.
They would kill one, right? Because that's what they do.
That's how they roll.
They would go get one and they'd kill that mofo and they'd cut it open.
Yeah.
Do you know, about a month ago, I was in Dublin on business, and I had a few hours to kill, and I went to the Natural History Museum in Dublin, which I hadn't been to in a really long time, but I go to the Natural History Museum in London a lot, and it's this huge Smithsonian type building. It's just enormous.
Sure.
It's much, much bigger than the Natural History Museum in New York City, for example. Fantastic museum.
Sure it is.
The one in Dublin is tiny. But the beautiful thing about the one in Dublin is it's exactly the way it was 150 years ago before people had television and could see wildlife documentaries.
Right.
And Dubliners call it the dead zoo. And it's just full of stuffed animals. The polar bear actually has a bullet hole in its head.
No.
Where they just shot it and dragged it out off whatever ice cap it was on, stuffed it, put it in the museum. There was no pretense about it. Oh, let's get these animals.
Oh, that's what they did back then.
We can't bring them in alive. Right. Shoot the damn thing.
Teddy Roosevelt, when he was no longer president, went to Africa and went on an expedition across Africa. And I think he was working for I forget if he was collecting for the Smithsonian or for the Natural History Museum in New York. But he shot he cataloged 25,000 animals.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was just a swath of death and destruction.
He was a killing machine.
He was. But I mean, he didn't kill all of them himself. But, yeah. I mean, that's what they did back then.
But if you ever get the chance, if anybody listening is ever in Dublin, honestly, go to the Natural History Museum. It's free to go in. It's a tiny little building, but it's a perfect example of how natural history museums used to be.
Right, that's cool.
Just full of dead animals. There's no real pretense about science. Just, God, can we get some more animals? Let's get a bear this time. Let's
shoot another one. Bring it in here.
No, we don't. We don't just need a big bear. We need a baby bear as well. Get us a baby bear. Get us a baby bear. Bring it back. Yeah, that'll be great. No, we need to pose it in a scary pose.
Could you get one that's a little more brown?
Yeah, and that's what they did. And the polar bear is fantastic. It has a bullet hole in its head.
So I guess to answer Dan's question, he says, do you guys agree or disagree? I guess if Scott was here, obviously the answer would be different.
He would be strong, yeah.
Right, he'd be with you, Dan. Scott is your man. No, I don't agree. And I think Sam's right. If you could, and you can't, because these aren't the kind of animals that are going to sit down and let you take this kind of footage of them. And there are animals like that in the wild kingdom of animals, right? I mean, there actually are others that won't sit still and allow you to take great pictures of them. So if these would let you do that, that would be pretty compelling, but I don't think that it would get away from the body problem, because that's a science thing, not a Bigfoot thing.
Yeah. I tell you what, this last weekend we had a couple of days, so we went out to Massai Mara reserve in southern Kenya for a couple of days, because I had no work to do. And there was an interesting incident where we happened across a cheetah, and it was sort of doing whatever cheetahs do.
Cheating.
Making cheetahs. What happens with these guides is when they see something, they get on the radio and tell all the other guides in the park that there's something interesting to look at. And so within minutes, all these other Land Rovers and Toyota Land Cruisers are turning up with American and European tourists to look at whatever it is you've been looking at. And the fascinating thing about this was that as soon as other vehicles started turning up, this cheetah very slowly and carefully walked away from it was, almost patty-like, to an area in the middle, and it right into the open, instead of going into the bush where it could have gone, went right out into the open and sat down with trucks all around it looking at it, and it stayed there. It must have been 20 minutes before we left.
Did it start doing that weird cat thing where it hikes its leg up in the air and starts licking the inside of its thigh?
I couldn't help thinking it's done that on purpose. There's no reason for it to do what it's done, unless it had young that it was drawing the tourists away from.
That's a good thought.
That's the impression it gave me. There was no reason for it to do what it did unless it was trying to draw attention away from where it had been.
Well, and that's something a lot of people have said about the PGF over the years. But
yeah, I know it's speculation. But when I watched this happen with the cheetah, that's exactly what I thought of. Sure. Because it didn't need to. There was bush it could have gone and hidden in. It could have. I mean, let's face it. It's a cheetah. They can run bloody fast if they want to.
Well, I know because I've watched Animal Planet that cheetahs do leave their little young sort of like stashed away somewhere where they go off and do the hunting. So that's not a bad theory.
Yeah, but it just went out in the middle of probably 50 yards away from where it had been and sat down.
Huh. That's interesting.
So yeah, I don't think
Bigfoot don't do that.
Bigfoot don't do that. Well, we can't prove that they exist. We need to put them in a park like Massai Mara so that tourists can go and gawp at them. And there was a point at which when we encountered the leopard, I actually felt a little bit sorry for the leopard because all these tourist vans and pickups.
That's his job. Don't feel bad for him. That's his job. That's what he gets paid to do.
But as I said, it was interesting. Well, the first thing I thought of was PGF.
Well, here's a bit of a connection there. Listener Zephyr Windyman, I'm fairly certain that's not his real name. And he also looks a lot like Wilford Brimley, which is odd. But Zephyr Windyman, he said, I've heard a lot of Bigfoot discussion veer into arid Beckyard territory lately. What's up with that? What is up with that?
He's right.
I think Yes.
Is it because of the Finding Bigfoot thing? Is there just more people interested and they're crazy, or what do you think?
No, I don't think there's any more people. There are more crazy people than there used to be before Finding Bigfoot. It just might be that they're finding Bigfoot. The crazy people are finding Bigfoot as a subject. Do you know what the one thing that the internet has done is enable crazy people to contact each other and talk to each other, regardless of whether they are interested in Bigfoot or whether they are interested in transvestite porn or whatever. There are people that would never have come into contact with each other that have sat on their own and been interested in their own little niche. And now, with the aid of the internet, the crazies can talk to each other.
It's like online dating is what you're saying.
It's the internet is just it's just enabled crazy people to talk to other crazy people when they wouldn't have been able to find them before.
Like what we're doing right now.
Yes.
See, I think it's like
But for every three or four sane people that find each other and can talk sanely, there will be crazy people that can do exactly the same thing. And
Well, why do we have to put up with them? Sam, what do you think?
I think it's like Aristotle said, nature abhors a vacuum.
Wow.
And as long as Becciard was alive, he was the fringe element in large part. I mean, there were a few other, contenders to the crown, so to speak. But I mean, he really held sway as the head nut job.
Yeah. Nobody was able to out lunatic him.
Right. I mean, he would, you know, no matter what you did, he was there to out crazy you. I mean, as soon as you tried That's to true. Step your game up, he would do something even crazier. And when he passed, I think that created a vacuum. And suddenly, you know, all these other people started to sort of infill that area and trying to assume the mantle that he had held. And I think, too, Paul's right to an extent. I mean, the internet does make it easier for people to communicate. And so someone who might normally just be living in their mother's basement and, not really developing.
Or their grandmother's basement.
Or their grandmother's basement, yeah. But, you know, I mean, these people who might otherwise just be, you know, social outcasts and miscreants suddenly have this worldwide audience.
These are our people.
Yes, this is our target audience,
Social outcasts and miscreants.
but, yeah, it empowers them. And also, too, and I blame this partly on this sense that we suddenly have to be accommodating, or that we have to be polite to everyone. When the first version of the BFF went down, one of the big criticisms was that it was just a bunch of mean, nasty skeptics and cynical people who were tearing down all of these witnesses and knowers and chasing off all of this this good evidence and running all these people out of the game. And so we're going to take a whole new tact, and we're going to be nice, and we're going to be polite, and we're going to make sure that everybody gets a clean shake. Well, that's great and grand in a utopian society where nobody is crazy. But in our society, which is the real world that we live in, there are crazy people, and there are nut jobs, and there are people who just want attention and who are going to say whatever they think they have to say in order to garner the attention that they want. And if you don't have people out there who are willing and ready and able to call them out on it, it's just going to encourage them. It's going to enable them. And sooner or later, others are going to see that as an example and say, hey, that guy's getting away with it. I bet I can get away with it too. And then you end up with a situation where not only are they enabling the activity, but you have people literally trying to one-up one another. And it's back to the Becciard of, I will out-crazy you. Yeah. No matter what you do, I can do something even crazier.
Yeah.
That's my rant.
That's depressing. I can't believe you just dropped Aristotle on the show.
I got to bring something to it.
Yeah. Yeah. The hick from the south brings up Aristotle.
Yeah. That's the great part. The farmer.
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions about Area X. I'm going to do all those at the end. All together.
I think it's time you changed it to Y.
Well, we had Y.
Oh.
There was an X and I've told this story. There was an X and a Y and a Z, and X is the only one left. We had a Y. No.
Z.
No.
Z.
But for people who are we are specifically not talking about Rick Dyer, just so you know. Yes. We agreed before the show.
Well, he's one of the crazies. So there's no point talking about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
horrible. Horrible. James McDaniel, comments on some of the more off-the-wall theories about Bigfoot being an alien or an interdimensional being. Well, I mean, we're kind of talking about that right now, right? Here's the interdimensional being thing. Here's what I know, and I know this. These things are wicked fast. These things are stealthy and sneaky ass, and they can move like crazy. And I think that if you're a little soft upstairs, that could, I mean, if you have an experience like that, you could say that they're interdimensional. I mean, I think I said this when I was talking about what I saw. If I was the kind of person who would be willing to ascribe, supernatural powers, what I saw, yeah, I'd totally go there. Because it didn't seem, it was crazy, right? But no, they're not actually interdimensional.
Yeah, no, I could believe that. And I think, we never used to talk about it on the show by name, but when we met Crazy Sherry,
yes,
back in 2004, yeah, couldn't help get the feeling that there was a tiny nugget of truth there, that there had been some kind of encounter.
Yeah,
and she just couldn't cope with it and went crazy because of it.
So this is a person that Bob and Kathy Strain, actually, we should have them on at some point talking about this. It's a fascinating story. A woman who claimed to have had activity on her property, that she'd seen a Bigfoot on her property. And as they investigated it, the claims just got crazier and crazier. And absolutely. At a later date, they actually found some evidence on her property that made them believe that perhaps there had been something that happened there. But clearly she was just leading them along and saying just the craziest crap because she was a lonely old woman and she wanted people.
Yeah,
to talk to her.
I can remember Kathy saying at one point that, that kind of got to the stage with her where when they hadn't given her any attention for a couple of weeks, right, she'd phone up with an encounter that evening. You know, there'd be Bigfoot right outside the door.
I remember we went into her house this weekend. we went into her house and there were pictures of there. I'm not lying. There were framed photos of Bigfoot and Jesus all over the house. And then you start to understand if you're conflating those two things, maybe you're not the best witness at this point. I'm just saying.
But I couldn't help feeling when I met her that the area that she was in was it. For want of a much better expression, it was very squatchy.
Oh yeah, totally.
And I couldn't help thinking that she may just have had an encounter that her brain just couldn't process properly. It may not have even been a Bigfoot, but something happened to her. I'm convinced that something happened to her. That she put down to Bigfoot and then started going crazy. And the worst thing about it, and we're going back to people with this audience, is she was coming into contact, this lonely old woman was coming into contact with people that were paying her attention.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, she's got two people flying over from England to talk to her.
Right. No, that's probably a highlight of her life right there.
Yeah, we were just feeding the crazy.
I still have that interview.
I think we all felt really bad about the way we were kind of feeding the crazy that weekend.
I should send you that interview because I still have that. So Andrew Austin wants to know how much wood would a Bigfoot chuck if a Big Chuck could chuck wood? How much wood would a Bigfoot chuck if a Bigfoot could chuck wood?
Yeah.
I say, the question is over what period of time?
Yes.
This is not a.
We're talking about a juvenile.
I think a juvenile, right? Is it fall? Yeah. Is this green wood?
I think we've got to quantify what sort of wood. I mean, how do we measure it? Do we measure it by mass?
Is it a hardwood or
by
it like
size?
A pine?
Or, yeah. I don't think he's really framed the question very well.
I'm going to say in 10 minutes, which is an arbitrary period of time. Of
42.
42. Yes, that's the answer. 42. I think a Bigfoot could chuck between half a cord and 1 1/4 cords of wood in 10 minutes, depending on the density of the wood and the age of the Bigfoot. Sam, you're a farmer. What do you think?
Over what distance?
A cord is a deceptively large amount of wood. I mean, until you've actually had to load one, you don't really appreciate how much wood that is.
Bigfoot are pretty big.
I'm going to say, if I've got my terminology correct, I'm going to say it would be a rick, which is 1/2 of a cord.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, that's on the low end of my estimate, sure.
Yeah.
Now, no, Paul, not chuck, like throw, chucking wood. It's like he's like chewing it on or something, right? Is that what chuck means? Like it's because it's how much wood would a woodchuck chuck? Woodchucks are, anyway, never mind. There you go, Andrew.
We don't call them woodchucks where I live. They're called groundhogs.
We don't even have them over here. Well, no. I say over here. I don't know what's over here. There's all sorts of shit over here. But where I live, we don't have woodchucks.
Paul Elliott wants to know who the most batshit crazy person in Bigfoot is.
I think we already covered that at the start of the show.
Now,
all right, done.
Now,
I don't know. Paul, do it. Let's start a flame war. Go ahead.
You're going to get sued. I just want to, whatever you say is not my, it's not, no, I don't want
to. Yeah.
Do
you know what? I couldn't name an individual person. I would have to draw up a list. I don't even put them in order.
The craziest person has been mentioned on this show already. I think Sam's correct. Here's a serious one.
That's no way to talk about Scott. We like Scott.
Well, he's not here.
Okay.
Jean Saint Jean. I don't know how to say her name. I like it when you guys mention Bigfoot books that are among your favorites. It helped me to separate the wheat from the crap in my reading. Well, that's not really a question, is it? That's just a statement.
Yeah.
I thought she was going to ask for book recommendations.
Well, I already mentioned mine. I mean, John Napier's book is just outstanding. Yeah. And it's really kind of underrated in the pantheon of Bigfoot books that are out there. I mean, John Green always gets a lot of credit. Lauren Coleman, like him or not, he's a very prodigious writer on the subject. Jeff Meldrum's book. But Napier's book really, if you're wanting to separate the wheat from the chaff, that's the book you need to read. He gives it a fair shake. He's very objective about how he looks at the evidence. And if people had listened to him when that book came out, there's a lot of things in this subject that we're talking about now that no one would even be given the time of day.
Huh. That's cool.
I don't know what my favorite book is. I mean, I we've had this conversation before, and actually. One of my favorite books is The Making of Bigfoot. It's because it's a fascinating book. It from the point of view of somebody that has just gotten the wrong end of the stick. But it does bring up an awful lot of interesting subjects that if you read it with a degree of skepticism, it's a really interesting book to read. But I still like Lauren Coleman's book. If somebody said to me,
which one, Bigfoot?
The Bigfoot, North American Apes, or whatever it's called, true story of apes in North America. Yeah. If somebody were to say to me, give me one book to read, I don't know anything about the subject, give me a book to read. I used to say that I would give Lauren Coleman's book. Now I'd be more inclined to give Jeff Meldrum's book to them.
Really? I think part of it, I think that book needs to be updated.
I think it needs to be updated. I think there's an awful lot in it that's long or needs revising.
Well, and there's also some new stuff. But I think there's new stuff.
But it's a good book. It's got pictures. If somebody lots says they don't know anything about Bigfoot, you want a book with loads of pictures.
Yeah.
But that and Coleman's book. Coleman gets a bad rap, I think. I understand why he gets a bad rap. People in the Bigfoot world do not like the idea of anybody else making money out of it when they're not.
Not making lots of money.
No, but he's making more than we are.
That's true. You got me on that one.
So I think it's a nice, small, easy to read book, and it covers an awful lot of ground.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, there's an awful lot of books out there I think that we've all read that are terrible. Yeah. I read one not so long ago. I won't name the author. But it's a well-known researcher. I got about 20 pages into it, and I had to write to them and say, this book, I feel dirty because I've paid money for it.
You have to say
you need a copy editor because you clearly do not understand how to write. Yeah. When a book is published and it doesn't understand the difference between through THREW and through THROUGH, then there's something wrong with the book. There's something wrong with the author. If they cannot write in English and understand the difference between TO and TOO, it's a book that should never be sold on Amazon.
I know some people that would give an aneurysm to.
TOO is when you're trying to be more formal, right? my favorite book, I've said this before and it still is, though I will say that Lyle's book gave it a run for the money. Lyle's book, the I don't know the title, but Lyle Blackburn, the Boggy Creek book, is really quite good. But my other favorite book is
it is a good book, but it's on a particularly niche.
No, it's very specific. No, this isn't like the only book you'd give someone if they didn't have a book. That's not the one. And I don't know which book I would say that I would tell them to read, I've said before, I love Raincoat Sasquatch. It's a great book.
Yeah. Yeah. Another one that really deserves some credit, and it's kind of a little bit under the radar too, is Don Hunter's book that he wrote with Renee Hinden. It's Sasquatch Bigfoot.
And I've read that book. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of hard to find. I don't think it's been in print for a while.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed that.
That was one of the first books I read on the subject.
Yeah, it was the very first one that I read on the subject, and just really great, particularly because it pulls no punches in representing Renee's views on things, right. Particularly some of the other researchers at the time and some of the things that were going on. And so in that regard, it's very entertaining. Plus, there's some really good just anecdotal stories that are included in it. Yeah. Things that he and John Green investigated. It's a good read.
That was the first book that allowed my in-laws to understand my interest in the subject and make fun of me. so there you go.
I think for the sake of completeness, I'd have to recommend one of Eric S. Brown's Bigfoot War books.
Oh, sure. Well, they are fiction. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
he just came out with a new one, right? Or is that a new one?
He comes out with books faster than I can read them. Yes.
The Bigfoot War 5, Planet Sasquatch. The cover is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I there's a Captain Vella in one of them.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Now we know. Now we know why the plug. All right.
I think Vella. His books are terrific, but he writes them too quickly. I don't have time to read them. He's actually writing them faster than I can read them.
So he's sort of like Stephen King that way. He just writes.
I think actually there's more than one Eric S. Brown. I think there's a little room full of them.
It's a pseudonym that several authors operate underneath. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it could be a room full of Sasquatch. You know, they that thing about the room full of chimps that could come.
They are people, you know. They could be writing books.
In infinite Sasquatch with typewriters.
Gareth Cummins wants us to give grief to everyone who believes in cloaking. What is he talking about?
This is the infrasound Bigfoot making themselves invisible because they've got Klingon cloaking.
Oh, see, this goes back to it's the interdimensional thing. Anyway, Sam, what were you going to say?
I think when it was brought up about who's the craziest, I think this is who Paul was thinking about when he started to mention someone's name and then backed up.
Gareth?
No, not Gareth. No. Oh.
No. Yeah. I will not mention.
I think, and going back to a little bit about what Brian said about, you know, what he experienced and how if he'd been in a certain frame of mind, it could have been interpreted differently. Mm-hmm. I think this speaks in at least some sense to people's unfamiliarity with just how stealthy animals can be in their own environment.
I completely agree with you.
All I'm going to say on the subject is obviously this weekend, I did this great trip out and watched African elephants in the wild, and they do apparently communicate using infrasound, and none of them disappeared right in front of me.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. None of them. Right. Oh, do you know what? There might have been one or two that were cloaked, but obviously I wouldn't know about it because they'd be cloaked. Shit.
I hadn't thought this through. You need
properly.
To walk around with your arms outstretched trying to find the invisible elephants.
There might have been more of them.
There could have been.
Oh, jeez. I hadn't thought of that.
You could have been that guy.
I could have been the first guy on the tour.
But Sam, your point.
After the elephants.
Your point. I mean, you need to be out in the woods to witness this, but like, you know, a deer will leap into the woods and then it will seemingly evaporate in front of your eyes.
I've been out hunting before and looked at an area and seen nothing. Looked at that area again. Wow, there's a deer. Yeah. Watched the deer, and then suddenly the deer is not there, and there it is again. It's evolution has created these animals to survive, and one of the ways that they survive is by being, you know, elusive and knowing how to use their environment.
Yeah.
And it's also a matter of our unfamiliarity of being in that environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, on the same trip, I saw a dead zebra that had been eviscerated, essentially.
Do you pronounce it zebra when they're dead and zebra when they're alive?
No.
Oh,
they're never zebras. They're zebras.
No, they're not. But
the letter is Z. It's not.
Go ahead. You saw a dead zebra.
When Brad Pitt is on the BBC and he refers to his movie as World War Z,
that's the PR department telling him what to say.
It's a Z. Is it ad and bad and cat? No. Why does Z get special treatment in the alphabet?
Because it doesn't exist. It's a Z.
Whatever. You saw a dead black and white striped horse thing.
A dead black and white pony thing. I'm not joking. It took me about 3 or 4 minutes before I realized that there was a lioness eating the damn thing.
Yeah. Well, those things, they blend right in, right?
Because it's the same color as
its carcass.
Crawling out of the rib cage.
It's the same color as the grass, and you just can't see it. It's right in front of you, and you can't see it. But that's not cloaking. It's the same color as the grass. It's not using infrasound to cloak. It's just camouflaged, and there's a big difference between the two. Right. And quite frankly, anybody that can't figure out the big difference in the two needs to see a psychologist.
I feel completely out of the loop. I must have been in the woods for too long because I'm not sure who you're talking about, this cloaking thing. Everybody who apparently listening to the show is going, it's so-and-so, but I have no idea. maybe someone will IM me this.
I'm off somebody's Christmas card list.
I will provide my own little anecdote to it. This past Saturday, a friend and I, we went out and did some hiking and some squatching.
Actual squatching?
Yes, actual squatching.
Oh, excellent.
We did not make contact with our target species, but we had a good time. And at one point during the day, we had hiked up to the top of this ridge, and the underbrush was really high. I mean, it was waist high or higher, and there was a trail that had been worn down through the middle of this. And it was one of those situations where if you were to come from the trail from either side, you would never see it until you were standing on it, and only when you were on the trail could you see where it went and follow it. And we were talking about how this would be advantageous to something like a Sasquatch to be able to use the terrain like this to its advantage to move through this area, and how even assuming that this thing could be 7-8 feet tall, it could literally have been laying off the trail to either side of us, and we would have never known. We would have walked right by it just because this stuff is so thick. And not 5 minutes later of having this conversation, we're starting to hike down from the ridge, and we jump a deer that was no more than 15 feet in front of us, and neither one of us ever knew that deer was there until it jumped up and ran across the trail.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it just illustrates that point again. And I think if you're someone who is already open to the possibility of anything, if you're that type of credulous individual,
and you hear, you called them in the
creduloid, yes, yes. If you are a creduloid. With a high degree of credulity, and you hear these accounts of actual things happening. I mean, someone out there says, you know, I saw the Sasquatch and then poof, it was gone. It's very easy for you to make that leap and say, oh, well, you know, obviously they must have employed, you know, cloaking or whatever it is. And then you just take that ball and you run with it, and you add that to the lore that you are creating around this creature. Which is just one more reason why we need one, because then we can shut all these people up.
I remember someone who used to be in the BFRO saying that they'd received a report, and somebody else in the BFRO, who is a well-known crazy person in the field, the person in the report said that the Bigfoot disappeared into the trees. And everyone except this crazy person assumed that they meant what they said, in that you know, it went into the trees and disappeared as animals do. This person said no. They said it disappeared, right? Like, no, it didn't.
A little tree portal into the nether.
Yeah, some sort of like little, yeah, like on what was that movie with the little dwarves? Time Bandits. Okay. Are there any other questions in the list that you guys wanted to get to that I didn't get to? I did skip over some of them because I think we've covered them before or whatever.
A lot of them dealt with the same thing. I mean, there were several sort of on the same topics.
All right. I'm gonna sort of nail some of these X questions then.
Go on, then. Should we talk about Sykes first? Is there anything to talk about?
I'm disappointed in Sykes. I'm really disappointed in Sykes. He was supposed to have published, right? I mean, he had a schedule on his site of when he was going to publish. And now there's like this talk of him on a TV show, and God knows what's going on there.
I think we talked about it. I never thought his schedule was realistic.
No, it seemed really aggressive. Right, it did. It did.
To get a proper peer reviewed, especially on this subject, is going to take time. And it just makes me wonder what the hell he's doing.
I think he's going to be on TV now. I think it's the siren song of television has captured
him in.
It doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me.
No. And I'll tell you from the standpoint, I mean, because I'm in an organization that provided him a sample, and we have absolutely no idea what the status of that sample is. None whatsoever. We've been told nothing about it. And
that's because you're not going through the official channels.
Well, and I presume it's going to be on this TV show.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm waiting to see.
Yeah, I guess I got my finger crossed because he's a real guy, right? But it doesn't smell good. It does not.
I can't help getting the feeling that he might have done what Ketchum's done and used these little envelopes you get at the shopping mall to send your DNA off.
I'm a little more cautiously optimistic with him than I was with Ketchum, mainly just because of his pedigree.
Mm-hmm. He has a reputation.
Yes.
He has a reputation that Ketchum could only dream of.
If this thing ends up...
Yeah.
Yeah. If it ends up being crazy, I'm not going to be terribly surprised. Right. So,
I mean, he operates out of a university in Great Britain, whereas she operates out of a strip mall in, you know,
not just a university,
the university
out of Oxford University,
the university. All right,
we talked about the university Bill Clinton went to.
I sure hope. Yes, he did. He absolutely did. I sure hope the Sykes thing turns out to be well, but at this point, I personally am sort of disillusioned and not.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see anything. I think we might see a few TV interviews, but I don't think we're going to see a paper.
Right, and you know the other side of it. Some people I've heard this surmised that maybe he discovered something really big, and in the case of that, and so now they're going to make it a big TV production. But I don't think we have any reason to believe that.
There is a precedent for that. I mean, there have been discoveries recently in the last, 4 or 5 years where something significant happened. And before it was published, they were already working on, you know, the Nat Geo special or the Discovery special afterwards.
Right.
Didn't we have a NASA televised discovery that was later withdrawn in the last 12 months?
Ah, yes. There was going to be a big announcement about something they had found on Mars.
And then they pulled back on it.
Oops.
Apparently the publicity people hadn't talked to the scientists.
Yeah.
Well, they called up for this is not related, but it's probably something like this. The NTSB intern who... Anyway. We won't go there. Okay. So, Sykes, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so X.
X questions. Start at the bottom here. Where's the dude who wanted to know about anybody getting hit by a rock? Oh, Jim Towner, in all the X rock chucking, did anyone ever get hit? Yes. No one ever got hit seriously, but I believe that a few members have had sort of incidental contact with stones that were thrown, and but it's not nothing serious. Nobody was injured or bled or anything like that.
And the problem is you can't see the stones coming because they're cloaked until they hit you.
They are. See, the residual cloak energy. Yeah, the residual cloak energy is attached to them. So
yeah, they fly through the air. About halfway through, they decloak.
Yeah, it really sucks when they come flying out of that you know,
time warp.
You
know, that was the one little bit of excitement we had on Saturday was we were back out that night and we were doing some audio surveillance and some video surveillance, and I'd made a call, and right after I made the call, I'd put my headphones on. I was using a parabolic microphone, and so as soon as I make this call, I put the headphones on and I crank the gain up on the microphone, and I'm listening really intently to see if we get any kind of reaction or whatever. And about that time, I'm assuming a hickory nut fell from the tree above us uh-huh. and landed on the roof of my vehicle right beside me with the parabolic microphone pointed right at it. And this is the second time now that has happened to me. And let me tell you, just because it's happened once before, it does not lessen the shock of it at all. It's like a gun going off right beside your ear. And yeah, that was great.
Who was it? Paul, do you remember back on the old BFF? It may have been Tim Cullen, but maybe not. Maybe I just assigned this to Tim over time, who went into the Florida Everglades to look for skunk apes and saw like these two eyes looking at him. And it turned out to be those little reflective tacks that people can put on like poles and stuff. But he looked at this thing for a really long time, and I was convinced that he was seeing like these glowing eyes looking at him. Then it was those little reflective tacks.
I know somebody that did that on purpose.
Yeah. I don't remember who it was. It would have either been, I mean, it's Florida. It would have either been Tim or Jim Flowers.
Oh yeah, it could have been Jim. That's a good point. I bet it was Jim.
It's one of those things. Those little reflective stickers. Tim used to go geocaching, and there's a lot of people do night geocaching where they find these little reflective sticker things.
Night geocaching? There's like a night version of it.
Yes, they do it with torches, and you have to find.
Flashlights, not actual torches.
Torches, flashlights,
no, sticks like. With fire on top is not what they.
Yeah. Say. Okay. Flashlights where you have to navigate by using these little reflective markers. So it might have been Tim, because Tim was big into geocaching at the time. But it'll either be Tim
no,
or Jim.
I think it was Jim Flowers, now that you mentioned it. I think that's true. Another person, Tim Sievert, says, how many separate entities are believed to be inhabiting Area X? We've heard about Old Gray, but are there any others that have been singled out for naming? The number is a really good question, and it's you know, I think I may have said in a previous show that there have been instances where we believe there may have been up to, you know, six animals around the area where our people are. But there's really no way to know exactly how many there are. And we have had encounters that where, for shorthand, we've sort of assigned names to the animals. But, of course, there's no way to know. You know, the gray one is interesting because it's big and it's gray. And gray is a really odd color. And if you look at, like, the database of all the encounter reports that the NAWAC has ever worked, gray, it's a very small percentage. So we believe that unless there's like 150 of them around there, and there's probably not, that this gray one is the same thing that we're seeing every time. But other than that, yeah. You know, there's been a black one that we call Old Blackie. Not Old Blackie, I'm sorry, we just call Blackie. Not all old, right?
Old
Blackie, Old Gray, you know, Old Brownie. You know, no. No, we call it Blackie because, you know, we're real creative with the names sometimes.
Pinky and Greeny.
And the brain. Don't forget the Pinky and the brain. There's a where I may have seen one the last time I was in there. We've actually had at least three people have visual encounters in the same spot. And it's a similar sort of reddish brown animal. And that one we call Beelzebub. That's a really good name actually for one of these. So it may not be the same one, but it looks the same. And this is the thing. The gray one is distinctive. These other ones are not, you know, they're brown and they're black. So, you know, there are some other names that we've assigned, we don't know that they're.
But of course, I mean, the color, of course, will depend entirely on time of day and
partially
surroundings.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what sort of foliage is around? You could well see the same thing twice, and it'll have two different appearances.
Yeah, I mean the one that Paul Bowman saw just recently in that same area that you know where Beelzebub hangs out. It was brownish, and then it walked in. The sunlight sort of splashed off of its coat, and it was reddish brownish. It sort of like you know lit up in that way. And so yeah, absolutely. The time of day, the shadows, the all kinds of things will affect how it appears. So yeah. So I don't have an answer of how many are
and
there.
Whether or not they're cloaking. So.
True. I mean, it could be sometimes when they're in the middle of cloaking, they get kind of grayish. But that only happens for a second, then they blink out and you don't see them at all. Paul Elliott, what's the latest in Area X? Dude, listen to the last show. And if you were
get with it, man, come on.
If you were to shoot a Squatch, have you given any thought to what the other Squatches might do in response? Yes, and yes. A lot of that has to do, the way we think about it is it was sort of like the way that gorillas and other large primates operate, and it depends on who you shoot, right? If you get like if you were to take out a silverback in a gorilla troop, chances are the rest of the gorillas would take off and you'd be fine. But if you were to shoot a breeding female or a young one, you might have some issues to deal with.
I don't think anybody could predict how they would react.
That's the end. At the end of it, there's no way to know.
And I say that as somebody that years ago rescued my wife from being attacked by a cow.
That's true. I remember that story.
That was absolutely out to kill her and was grinding her into the ground the way a bull would.
Right.
And it's just a domestic cow.
Right.
You just don't. Sometimes animals act in ways that you just don't expect them to.
Right. So I mean, to answer the question is we really don't know, and all we can do is be as cautious as possible. And if and when we're given the opportunity, we'll just be as cautious as we possibly can.
But the really neat thing is you all fitted out with those cloaking devices, so when they charge, you can just.
Well, what I'm thinking is, you know, you've got the body; you can just take its cloaking device.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? That's a much better idea. Yeah.
Assuming that it's, you know, going to work with our differences in physiology and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You just got to find the Stephanie Beecham aliens in the mountain behind.
The what?
Stephanie Beecham. She was in the Million Dollar Man episode with the Bigfoot.
Oh, wow. That's going back.
She was one of the aliens that was controlling the Bigfoot.
Wow. Okay, and then Brad Turner says, "When does Brian think we'll have a specimen from X?" You know, I'll be really frank about that. I can't tell you when. But my this summer has been a remarkable learning experience. We've been able to deploy some new equipment. I'm not going to get really into the details, but we've got a new thermal device. We have now two thermal devices on site, and I'll tell you that we've had some hard visual encounters with these that we feel very strongly were the target species, as Sam said. So my feeling about this right now is that it is a matter of time. Where we've been able to put ourselves is that we are basically where anybody else who is in a hunting situation. Sometimes the animal's going to win those encounters, and sometimes he's not. It isn't like, you know, if you don't hunt, you may think that you just go out in the woods and you shoot your gun and then you have dinner. But the case is that many, many times, often, you don't have that opportunity. It's not the right shot or whatever.
Unless you're me.
Unless you're an absolute stud. Like
exactly.
Right. So, I mean.
But the bottom line is that we're talking about an animal that to date nobody has been able to kill.
Well, I don't know. You know, I think that, you know, this is one of the things that...
Well, at least there's no proper document.
Right. No one's brought one in. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So it's a matter of luck and time. Assuming they exist, and it is a... For me, it's still an assumption.
Sure.
It could be next week. It could be 15 years.
It could. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm speaking from what I know of what we're doing. You know, it could be tonight. It could be next week. It could be next year. The problem we have right now from an organizational standpoint is that we've been on site now since like late April. You know, this is when we started. So we're running out of bodies. We're running out of people to be on site. You know, it's now, you know, in its third month. And so, you know, if the opportunity arises, It's going to happen. So I can't say when, because I don't know when that opportunity is going to arise. And every time there's a bit of a flip of a coin. And, as anyone who has hunted knows, and we'll see what happens. So I don't know. I can't say it'll be like by the end of October. I have no idea.
Yeah. I kind of am thinking back to a BBC documentary a good few years ago. It must be about 2003, 2004, where they had sent a cameraman off into northern Pakistan to film snow leopard. And they had gone to an area where they knew there were snow leopards. And they found a rock face where they knew there was a snow leopard living there.
Right.
And the cameraman camped there for over 80 days before he saw it.
I remember that. And he was like down, he was like hidden.
He was hidden and was there. And, the reality was that in over the next sort of 2 hours, he got more footage of a snow leopard than anybody had ever got combined in the history of filming snow leopards.
All he had to do was sit in this little crevice for 80 days.
But he had to be persistent and sit there. But he knew that it was there.
Right.
And he still had to wait, nearly 3 months before he could see it.
Right. It's one of the things you see on the internet is these suggestions of what technology we can deploy. Thermal, for example, we now have two thermal devices, but that isn't magic. You know, I can't see through leaves with a thermal device. I can't see through. So you have to have a line of sight to the thing you're trying to look at.
Do you think perhaps the wildlife documentaries that we see these days have given people a false expectation of how easy it is to find animals?
Absolutely, any animal, not just. I mean, we've had some animals, animals you don't care about, like that'll hang out, and if you wanted to, you could take video of them all day long. But you're talking like raccoons and foxes and a deer. But I think that people have an unreal. It's just like CSI has made people think that they can walk into a room and figure out who killed somebody in 2 seconds just by looking around. I totally agree with that. So we've been going on for almost 2 hours. And my wife is making dinner upstairs, and it smells really good, and I'm starving. This is one of those weird we usually don't record on weeknights, but that's what we're doing this time.
And, yes.
We're doing it just for you people.
So just for you, because we love you so much. So I'm going to go around real quick. Sam, is there anything you want to talk about before we cut this off?
Yes, I want to go off on a tangent. Paul got to go off on several, so I want to go off on mine.
A dozen.
Yes. No, I just want to throw this out there because this is something else that came up over the weekend, and I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on the show before. There's a really great book out there for anybody who's interested in cryptozoology, even though it's not a cryptozoological book necessarily. It's called The Ghosts of Savo, and it's by an author named Philip Caputo. It's a really great read. If you get a chance, pick it up. I'm sure it's available on Amazon. Basically, what the book is about is an investigation of the man-eaters of Savo, the ghost in the darkness. What was his name? The actor. Anyways, there's a film about it. It's a really interesting bit of African history. Paul, you might... I don't know. You're in Africa, so surely someone near you must have heard about this. But anyway, it's a really interesting account. These two lions killed, I think it was estimated, over 100 people that were building a railroad through the area at the time. And,
you know, Africa's a big place, don't you?
Yes, it is kind of a continent. But anyways, so there was this guy, a British gentleman, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, who was overseeing the railroad construction at the time and eventually killed these two lions. And they are now on exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago. But what's really interesting about Caputo's book is they go in and they investigate these claims that were made at the time. And the approach they take is really applicable to our field. They go in, they try to reconstruct some of the things that happened. They go and they take samples from the stuffed lions. And it's a really great read. One of the things that Patterson had put forward was that he thought that these were relic Pleistocene cave lions. These were not African lions. These were actually a supposedly extinct lion. And so in that vein, it's something applicable to us. Eventually, the discovery they make is, in my opinion, just as interesting. but it's a good
read.
Don't
give it away. Don't give it away.
Yes, and that's my tangent.
So. Didn't you see some creepy ghost monkey movie recently?
Yes, yes. Oh, gosh, yeah. And now I've completely drawn a blank on the title. If you'll give me just one sec. You totally called me out, man. I wasn't ready.
Sorry, I wanted to talk about that. I just thought of it. Yeah, I thought that's what you're about to talk about when you said the Ghost of Tsavo. I didn't know. What were they called? They called them
The Ghost in the Darkness. In the movie. The movie's called Uncle Boon Mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. And it was won the Palme d'Or at the 2010 Cannes Film Festival. And it is a very esoteric film. I'm not going to come out there and say that you should run out and watch it because it's not everybody's cup of tea by any stretch of the imagination. But it has a very interesting character in it. The main character's son has become what they call a monkey ghost. And there are several instances through the film where you see these monkey ghosts. And the similarity between the monkey ghosts and the Sasquatch, and particularly some of the ways that the sightings are described, including some of the sightings that have taken place in X, it's very similar. The opening sequence, actually, what you see, it's just textbook Sasquatch up to the red glowing eyes.
Yeah, some of the pictures that you posted are just freaky.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
It's called Uncle Boon Mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives.
Rotten Tomatoes has it at 90%, so that's...
It does not deserve a...
it doesn't deserve 90%?
Let me...
Was it good or was it not good?
I thought that it was really good. But what you have to understand is you are watching a low-budget movie from Thailand. And if you're not even familiar with the differences in foreign cinema, if what you know about cinema is American filmmaking, you're going to be in for a rude awakening. And that's kind of why I put that caution out there, because I know a lot of people like that who all they know about film is Hollywood. And you show them something, from Hong Kong or something like that, they can't digest it. This movie in particular, because of what it's about, and because of how it's done, I could see somebody really struggling with it. Well, I found it fascinating.
Here's the blurb from Rotten Tomatoes. I'm on Rotten Tomatoes. Suffering from acute kidney failure, Uncle Boon Mi has chosen to spend his final day surrounded by his loved ones in the countryside. Surprisingly, the ghost of his deceased wife appears to care for him, and his long-lost son returns home in a non-human form.
Literally. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. They're sitting at the dinner table. It's him and his sister and, one of the guys who works for him. And all of a sudden, the ghost wife just appears, and they start talking to her like she had been on vacation and had just come home. While they're talking to the ghost wife, and it's actually really poignant. I mean, what he says is really poignant, and that's kind of where you have to suspend the – wait, holy crap, that's a ghost. What he's saying is really meaningful and poignant. And he talks about thinking about her and everything. It's really sweet. While he's talking to the ghost wife, the monkey ghost son walks into the house and also sits down at the dinner table. So
awesome. No, I wouldn't like this movie.
I'm going to have to dig that out, I think.
Yeah. Right. It's on Netflix. Amazon Prime. That's where I watched it.
We can't get that here.
No.
Or there or wherever.
Wherever you are. All right. How much longer are you going to be there in Africa, Paulie?
On and off, probably till November.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
I have no idea. I'm flying home.
What's that?
I'm flying home tomorrow night, and I'm coming back in about 5 days.
What'd you say, Sam?
I was just going to say at least he won't have to miss the rains, but yeah.
Oh, no.
Do you know what? I went to a touristy restaurant last night, I think it was. Might have been the night before, where they serve meat. They got closed down temporarily.
What a concept.
A meat restaurant. But,
it's called Carnivore.
Nice.
Really good restaurant. It's kind of a little bit tacky, a little bit touristy. But the food's really good. But they just serve meat, and you could eat ostrich and crocodile and all sorts of bushmeat that they're illegally allowed to sell. But they got closed down in 2007, 2008 for serving zebra. And
stripy ponies.
And what else were they serving? But there was a point. There was a point at which there were. I'd had probably a glass of wine too many, and they come along with these big skewers, and they carve the meat at your table, and it's really good, and they just keep bringing more and more meat, and they said caribou to me, and I thought, oh, you know, okay, yeah, I'll have some of that. And I got it, and I thought, that doesn't taste like caribou. Caribou, it turns out, is the Swahili word for you're welcome.
Well, what
and what they'd actually given me was ostrich.
Oh, that's not caribou at all.
But yeah, it took me a while to figure out what the word was. Anyway, the point was that we're in this tacky restaurant. Slightly tacky restaurant, and would you believe they're playing bloody Toto over the screen?
Well, now I know what music we're going to go out on.
And I just couldn't help thinking, oh, could you just pick something else? I mean, you really have to. It's like having the twiddly D music in Dublin pubs. You know, nobody listens to that sort of shit. But you have to do it for the tourists, the American tourists that come over.
It's the Americans' fault again. Of course,
they like
it.
Yeah, you know, you've got to pander to tourists,
right? Yeah, especially Americans.
We don't get tourists from anywhere else these days. So I'm in this restaurant. I thought I feel a bit too touristy today, but the food is good. But it's been a, I tell you, it's been a tough. What are we? Close to 10 days now.
That's a long time to be away from home.
It's a long time to be away from home. It's the longest I've ever been away from the kids. As careful as you are with using bottled water only and everything else.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I made a good investment in a medical pack that I brought out with me.
Okay. Well, I need to go eat my dinner now. So that's excellent. It's a 2-hour show. There's got to be at least 20 minutes of content in there, and I hope you all can find it.
I'm looking forward to going home.
I bet you are. So I'm going to tell people, if you listen to us from iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review the show. That helps people find it. And we have a website, thebigfootshow.com. Go there. I don't know what you would do when you get there, but you can read things and see old episodes and so on and so forth. And thanks, guys, for hanging out. It was fun. And you're supposed to say, yeah, that's no problem. You're supposed to say caribou.
Caribou.
All right. I'll see you guys later.
Say.